Merry Christmas, Uprising fans. This is a special interview with Audit the Audit. Hope you enjoy it.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are the uprising. With Scott Cosenza.
I felt this thrill going up my leg.
There's not going to be a President Donald Trump.
A president! Can you believe it?
This is somebody who knows what's right and what's wrong.
You know what podcasts are, by the way?
Talk shows for people who cannot make it in talk radio.
I just want to say to the men in this country, just shut up, do the right thing. For a change.
I think possibly that's the most unattractive form in which prejudice can be met in this country, is the rage of the entitled.
On March 3rd, 1991, a 31-year-old plumber named George Holliday changed the world by recording the beating of Rodney King, or the arrest of Rodney King, I suppose, depending on how you view it. And that has spawned the legacy of that upon us now, with everybody carrying smartphones, is people recording the police all the time and displaying those police interactions on YouTube. One particular brand of those videos, or style or type of them, is auditing the police, which is putting oneself in a position where they will purposefully have an encounter with the police to see if those police honor their oaths, in a manner of speaking. As a special guest on The Uprising, we have Frank, not his real name, from a YouTube channel that features many of these videos and discusses their content. And I think it's a fascinating channel and topic. And Frank, with the limited contact I've had with him, is a very interesting person. So thank you very much for joining us, Frank.
My pleasure.
And Audit the Audit is the name of the channel. And you are on The Uprising today, and you declined to reveal your name, as you do on your channel, or anything about your identity. It's sort of the work speaks for itself, I guess. Do you want to tell us how the channel came to be?
Well, I have a background in journalism and digital content creation as a whole. And I also worked for several different print outlets and have been involved in the news business for a while. And I just, you know, I never really personally, the work that I create and my personal philosophies never really quite aligned correctly with what was expected of you in the news industry. So I, you know, started experimenting with different ways to branch out on my own and stay in my field to some degree. And, you know, I had always been aware of the auditing community and, you know, just police accountability as a whole. You come into contact with that subject, you know, throughout your news career.
What were the things in the news business that you didn't comport with or track along with that you thought were important friction points there regarding how they treat the police or interactions between police and people?
Well, it wasn't necessarily that particular thing. A lot of what I didn't like about the news industry was how much of a slave they tend to be to their advertisers. And, you know, the news industry as a whole is just sort of, it's moving in a more towards infotainment.
Right.
Style of news and less of a hard news. And, you know, I relish in the glory days of journalism, you know, like in the Pentagon Papers days and, you know, just when journalism sort of had grit. And it seems like that's kind of fallen away from the standard practices.
Well, now we've got these citizen journalists, right? I mean, that's...
Yeah, yeah.
Liberty Nation itself was founded in part to, as a response to what we were seeing in sort of legacy media properties. Well, there's so much citizen journalism happening now with these videos. Can you tell us, as you define it, what is an audit?
Well, it's hard to pin that down to like a specific thing, but, you know, because the thing about citizen journalism is that there's no rules to it. And there's, and auditing at its core is citizen journalism in a way. They definitely have common connections, but you know, it's sort of an audit, I guess I would say, is a way to, it's a way to hold your public officials accountable for their actions and their given duties. It's a way to, I guess, practically speaking in layman's terms, you know, you find yourself a camera, you find yourself a city, and you make sure that everything is operating correctly. And that may entail following a police officer or engaging with them, or maybe even a public official.
Is there, you know, one of the things that, so I'm a libertarian, I'm pretty out about it. And I know that politics is something that you don't want to get into in terms of our discussion, because you just want to be, I guess, the channel to be open for anybody and not get into, you know, and this isn't about electoral politics I want to ask about, but the relationship between the police and the policed is obviously, you know, to say it's a hot topic is an understatement. And I often find, Frank, that the popular notion of what happened in a given video is wrong from a pro-liberty perspective. And what I mean by that is, some significant amount of time, people seem outraged at a given circumstance, but yet they are proceeding from ignorance. And what I think is great about your channel is that it includes a giant helping of nuance into these discussions. So in particular, your discussion of how the perception that legal activity cannot be seen as suspicious, for instance, that kind of thing. Do you have you gone to law school?
No, but a lot of my journalism career has been spent on covering Supreme Court decisions and stuff like that. I considered going to law school, but, you know, I'm just really not a suit and tie corporate kind of guy. You know, I prefer to operate in the background and, you know, formulate, base my career around education more so than actual implementation of the law.
What do you have a, one of your videos that you would say, okay, if somebody's going to give the audit a chance, which particular video would you recommend them to see?
Oh, that's a tough question.
okay.
I think there's a fine line. Sorry. There's a fine line between what makes a good video and what I consider a good video, because a lot of the videos that I make that I'm really proud of that I like, you know, aren't very popular on YouTube, and they tend to, you know, I originally started my channel making videos that were both auditing audits, you know, and covering like the do's and don'ts of auditing. And then also covering legal topics as a whole. Like, I've made a video about whether or not you have to show your receipt at Walmart, and that and one
for
was
anybody,
okay.
For everybody listening, you do not have to.
You do not. But
let's just get into that for just a quick second as a public okay. service announcement to the audience, Frank.
Sure.
If you are going into a membership style store like a Costco or Sam's Club, where people have agreed ahead of time with the purchase of a membership or some agreement, they may be required under the terms of that agreement to show their receipt. I'm a Costco shopper, proudly. I do show the receipt at Costco. I know it's part of the thing going in. At Walmart or any other retail store, standard retail store, that's your stuff. You don't have to prove it to them at a subsequent checkpoint that it's still your stuff.
Yeah, that's right. That's absolutely right. But also, you know, at the end of every video, I sort of give an editorialized summary of my opinion towards it. And as I said in that video,
and let me interrupt, excuse me, very briefly, and a letter grade to the various participants often, which I appreciate. Again, piling on the nuance. Did you're not And I just want to say this because we do have police officer listeners of the Uprising. You know, you are not anti-police. In fact, you will often give a police officer an A or A plus rating if they comported themselves appropriately. Even in the context of violating citizen rights, police can do the right thing in terms of obeying all their other general orders and not being a jerk and so forth. So excuse me, back to the Walmart conclusion. I apologize.
Oh, no worries. Yeah, that's right. That's a big thing that I like people to know about my channel. But because oftentimes people will see one video where I give the cops an F, and then they think that, you know, that my whole channel is just about demonizing police. And that is certainly not the purpose of the channel. But anyway, although you don't have to show your receipt at Walmart, you're not going to, you know, create any grand philosophical changes about the way that Walmart operates by not showing your receipt. And although you may feel as though it is some sort of encroachment on your free liberties as a citizen, you know, it's really not, in my opinion, it's really not worth it to go through the trouble of causing a scene at Walmart just because you feel there's some kind of chink in your Fourth Amendment rights happening there. You know, I feel like rights are they're very rigid, and it makes sense for them to be rigid. But also, even rigid things bend sometimes, you know, so it's okay to show your receipt at Walmart. And I'm not by any means instructing anyone not to show their receipt at Walmart.
No, I'm the one instructing them on that, Frank. I disagree entirely. Okay, I want to say that right off the bat. As somebody I've actually been physically assaulted by a Walmart security guard for not showing my receipt. And by the way, it's not that I do so or don't do so to enforce my rights, although that's part of it. Mostly, I don't want to stop and stand in another line. I want to go to my car and leave if I go to Walmart. I don't want to stop and engage with the security person to see. I mean, that is stealing my time. And that's why I object to it. And of course, the other notion that, and I think that I want to maybe change your opinion on this, perhaps not during this interview, but maybe if you think about it later, you could come around, which is that what it does is it creates a culture of this inspection culture, of this deferring to authority culture, rather than an independence culture, which I would prefer to foster, so that people, you know, that's why I want to get the word out that you don't have to show your receipt. I would wish everybody would laugh or say to them, you know, are you crazy? I'm not going to stop for this inspection because I don't want them to heal, you know, to be so willing to turn over and submit to the theft of their time and their privacy. So that's sort of my speech about it.
Well, I think that that's a respectable opinion. And I don't think that you by no means are you wrong about that. And on the other side of the coin, you know, Walmart also doesn't have to check your receipt, you know, just as much as right. You know, I'm saying here that, you know, you shouldn't worry about whether or not you have to show your receipt. Walmart probably shouldn't worry about whether or not you should have to show your receipt either. You know, mm-hmm. So I believe that there's merit to both sides of that, both perspectives in regards to showing your receipt. But, you know, and like I said, I'm not going to demonize you or anyone else who refuses to show their receipt, because I believe that you are within your rights to refuse that. But I'm also, you know, me personally, you know, I'm not going to waste my time. Mm-hmm. You know, if I could show my receipt and just walk away, then that's my perspective on it. And I'm sure, like you said, that sort of probably propagates that societal perspective of authority, appealing to authority. But, you know, I prefer, you know, looking at it as a grand scheme sort of perspective, I would rather win tangible battles in the courtroom or somewhere else than waste my time dealing with Walmart.
Okay, that's a great segue, Frank, I think, to another one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on The Uprising. I watch these police interaction videos all the time. I have a, I don't know, maybe I've got a problem with that's what I'm drawn to, perhaps because of my background in liberty and in law. That's just where I'm focused. But one of the things that's a constant frustration for the viewer is, what happened next is the frustration. But you tell people what happened next. You take these videos when they are not just happened usually, but allow some distance in terms of some follow-up. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I mean, journalism is a major part of that channel. If anyone, has some nostalgia for, the old school style of journalism where you follow something from the beginning to the end and you try to leave the viewer or the reader without any questions, leaving their mind once they finish watching or reading. That's sort of like one of the major tenets of my channel. And, giving follow-up context is, I think it's necessary. It's absolutely necessary for you to understand, because oftentimes a lot of these interactions don't end the way that you want them to or the way that you expected them to. And oftentimes justice isn't served and there's not a happy ending to these stories. And that is something that the public needs to be aware of, because, it's up to us to hold everyone who we employ through our tax dollars to accountable for their actions. And if that's not happening, then there's a major flaw in the justice system,
Yeah. One of the things that I appreciate that you offer oftentimes is a description of exactly the training that a given officer has received. So the Mayberry Police Department, mandates 10 hours of de-escalation training per year. Where's it going? Look at the behavior of this officer. Although you don't say it in such an accusatory tone, but that's the idea, is that, and I appreciate that journalistic aspect to it, or not journalistic. It is journalism. You are digging up the facts there. And I think it's a rich, presentation of it. That notion that these things don't always work out how we would hope, I think, is vitally important. That see so many of these people who say, I'm going to have your job, or you're going to get fired or something like that. And even if those people's rights were violated by any fair reading of the law, oftentimes they receive no recovery.
Yeah. And I think another major problem is that oftentimes they don't seek recovery, and oftentimes they don't follow the proper channels to get justice. A major problem that I have with I'd say 99% of the auditing channels that are on YouTube, people who have built their careers around doing this, around going out and auditing, is that they don't follow up their interactions with legal action. They tend to just go out, provoke the police in some way, end up getting their rights violated, as they expected to, and then just moving on to the next audit. And that does nothing for the civil rights movement. That all that does is garner YouTube views and build this career on false accountability, because there's no accountability in that equation, and that's a major, I try to call people out on that. I try to hold auditors as accountable as I do the officers they interact with.
Yes, I'd noticed that you do. One of the things that I think you have to, and I'm not saying that you're insufficiently sympathetic, but it is finding legal representation to take one of these cases is not the easiest thing in the world. I can tell you, based on personal experience, I was detained because of my First Amendment speech by a police officer, illegally detained. He cursed at me and threw something at me. And I shopped that case around. I wasn't beaten or anything like that, by the way. I shopped that case around to probably 15 lawyers. I mean, I made a spreadsheet of who I wanted to call, asked for appointments, sent them the evidence and all that stuff. And I only got a couple responses, all of whom wanted to bill me to the tune of several hundred dollars an hour, requiring a, deep into four-figure retainer up front. And I think that, people don't have that a lot of times, or are willing to put those resources behind a potential loss, even in face of an actual violation.
Yeah, and I understand that. And I think that I'm not I'm not here trying to hold the average citizen to that standard. But when you've built your entire career and you're making a lot of money on YouTube through doing this, it sort of, to me, kind of robs you of some degree of your genuine nature. Or I feel like, you know, auditors who do that, they're selling a product, you know, like, here I am holding these police officers accountable, but when really they're not. And I see a lot of comments on their videos and stuff about how, thank you for what you do, your service, but there's really no end to that. There's no service being had. Like, there's a degree of there, you could argue that there's a degree of exposure that they're giving to the movement as a whole, but, you know, it, there's really no traction being gained there. And oftentimes they end up even shedding bad light onto the movement because of the way that they go about exercising their rights. And, you know, a lot of times auditors, you know, they, the way that they go about provoking the police is they do it in a manner that is not respectable. It's classless, you know.
And I will quote you, by the way, from one of your videos. This is more about the law than about class, but it's like when you talk about that legal activity can't be suspicious, you talk about a person wearing a ski mask while openly carrying a firearm, both legal activities. And then you'll see, and this isn't an actual example, but metaphorically, like, an auditor would be like, well, why are you hassling me? What, you know, because I'm black? And it's like, well, no, it's because you're wearing a ski mask and you have a gun, you're walking into a bank. Right. And I'm allowed to talk to you about that. You know, it's not like they've proned them out or tasered them, but.
And that goes back to what you said earlier about suspicious activity being, you know, grounds for an officer to make contact with you. Because a lot of people are under the misconception that as long as whatever they're doing is legal, that they should be free to do that thing without being intercepted by a police officer. And I think a lot of people really lack a full understanding of the Terry case. And, you know, they don't really know so much the facts of the case, but more so just an interpretation of what that case is supposed to allow them to do.
Don't think it, Frank. Know it for sure. Even most lawyers don't understand this. Can you, and I haven't asked you to prepare this ahead of time, so forgive me for putting you on the spot. Can you give us a breakdown right now, a thumbnail sketch of what Terry provides?
Sure. Well, it's a big picture, you know, and a lot of it has been involved in the courts many times. It's probably the most landmark case, in my opinion, involving police encounters with civilians to date. But it definitely
is the case that provides for the legal basis for most police officers to touch physically members of the public. That's, they get their hands on you because of Terry more often than not.
And it brought about the whole the doctrine of reasonable suspicion. And, you know, how that applies practically to citizen interactions with police. That's one of the major aspects of it. And I think that's one of the most widely misunderstood aspects of the case.
So for people who don't know, I just want to say a Terry stop or Terry frisk involves a police officer who does not have reason to make an arrest, but is engaged with somebody and allows them to pat them down for weapons in certain circumstances. Is that, right. Do you agree with that reading of the case?
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, where it gets tricky is with when they can go into your pockets or, you know, where it becomes a search versus a frisk. You know,
well, even before we get to that, excuse me for interrupting, whether they can actually, I think there's a misconception amongst police officers who often think they can do a stop and frisk on anybody because it's a Terry stop, but that's actually illegal. You have to be able to substantiate the Terry stop. You can't just being black or young or wearing a hoodie is not a good enough reason.
Yeah, but the problem with that is that a lot of interpretations that have come from even the Supreme Court have allowed officers to get by with circumstantial evidence that pretty much has nothing to do with the person that they're interacting with, such as being in a certain area at a certain time. You know,
right. Like near where they live, which happens to be a high crime area.
Right, exactly. And that is, you know, with every right that you have established that a citizen has had established in the Supreme Court, it feels as though the Supreme Court has also found a way to circumvent that right under certain circumstances, which are oftentimes ambiguous and subjective.
You often advise people during their encounters to remain silent as much as possible. There are occasions, though, where that has actually hurt some people. I'm thinking of the one video that you have, and I think I've watched all of your videos posted so far today. I think there are about 35 of them, and just for people, I'll give you the plug again. It's Audit the Audit on YouTube. If you search Audit the Audit, you can come up. You'll find it. This is a fellow who was photographing with a film camera, an old fashioned camera, outside of a police station, and officers just used the suspicion to seize his property. And he just he didn't assert that he was taking pictures because it was a First Amendment protected activity, and he sued and lost.
Yeah, that was in Des Moines, Iowa, and invoking your Fifth Amendment right to remain silent is definitely an important factor in any interaction with the police, as essentially anything you say, no matter how inconspicuous or innocent you may perceive it to be, it could certainly be used against you in some way, somehow. And, you know, attorneys, I'm sure you know, are notorious for being able to manipulate your intentions based on what you didn't say as much as what you did choose to say. So there's, you know, while it is important to remain silent, it is also important to justify what actions you are doing in as few words as possible. And oftentimes, if you're exercising your rights, that's all you have to say, so that if it does come into a courtroom, they can't speculate on what you were doing and why you were doing it. You know, that's where he, you know, that's what really got him caught up, is he did not specify why he was doing it, which left the courtroom open to interpret why he was doing it. You know, if you don't specify and say, I'm doing this to exercise my rights, then they're free to interpret what you were doing however they wish and pose the argument that, oh, well, maybe you were doing it for this reason or that reason. You know, so it is important to say something to justify your actions, but then balance that with saying things that don't incriminate you, you know. So it's a fine line.
Is there a sentence that you've thought of that you think, you know, does this particularly well?
Well, it's so circumstantial. It's really hard to give like a universal answer. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes, you know, in cases, one thing that you hear a lot through the Supreme Court is considering the totality of circumstances. And it's just really, there's not one. I think it would be ill-advised to give people or an audience a one, you know, one liner that they can always use. Because, you know, it's just,
Saying something like, I'm engaging in First Amendment protected activity? Is that,
yeah, if that's what you're doing, then yeah. Yes.
Right.
If you're protesting, if you're filming something, if you're, you know, but, you know, I will say that may not always work.
Because, well, yeah, no, you know, by the way, there's no get out of jail free card for a cop who doesn't care about the law, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. And a courtroom as well, you know, that doesn't really care about the law.
Roger that. I actually think that police are the cure for the problem we have with police in America. And what I mean by that is the good ones, and there are so many good ones, It's the tribal mentality where they don't crush their not good colleagues and drive them out of the force that has led us to where we are today, which I think is, you know, I referenced the Rodney King beating tape when we started. I think that when that tape went out, certainly most people, maybe most people who weren't in the underclass, as define that how you will, didn't think that police brutality was, or police abuse was so epidemic. But we know now, with the advent of everybody having cameras, that some fantastically high proportion of police officers are not necessarily themselves abusers, but are willing at some level to tolerate abuse from their colleagues without doing anything about it. And I suppose that's understandable, because they may put their own careers, they may explode their own careers if they, because of the culture in the police force. But that seems to be where we are. I read a story today about an NYPD officer who was indicted for perjury for lying and saying that a person tried to run him over. Now, that person was going to be thrown away for a felony for 15 years of their life. But here's the thing. That guy got prosecuted, but his partner, who knows that he lied about it and testified falsely in court about it, has not been prosecuted or fired.
Yeah, that is a tragic circumstance. And I definitely will agree with you that silent officers who consider themselves to be just and right are certainly a major problem. And it's a symptom, though, of police culture as a whole, which is something that hasn't been thoroughly researched enough. And it's often difficult to talk about police culture because it's really hard to find significant studies and good sources that have conducted good inquiries into the nuances that surround police culture and the psychological aspects of police culture. It's that, you know, officers not holding each other accountable is certainly a bad thing, but I don't think I necessarily agree that they're a cure for the problems, because you have to think about, if you put yourself in their position of being a good cop, you know, let's just go back for a second. Frank, did you ever see that movie that came out in the 70s? I think it was, I'm trying to remember his last name, Frank Serpio. He was
Serpico. Of course.
Yeah, Serpico. That's right. Yeah. So that is that shows that this problem of officers being corrupt where it not only extends way back, you know, along to the 70s and even, I'm sure, even before that, but that the problem that you're talking about of officers being complicit, it also extends back to that part, that time frame. And the fact that their lives are in danger, you know, now probably more than ever, because this has become such a deeply seated issue in our nation. And it's not unheard of to hear of people being killed after having, you know, held the police accountable in some respect. And so I think that they...
let me just stop you right there. What do you mean killed for holding police account? What does that mean?
Well, killed for, there was I can't remember the details of this because it's been years since I read this story. But there was actually, when the constitutional awareness movement started really getting flowing, when libertarianism sort of had its revamp, and there were a lot of auditors around, sort of more in like the 2008 to like 2012.
The Ron era. Paul moment, right?
Yeah, right, exactly. Uh-huh. There were a lot of auditors, but the movement wasn't really getting so much traction on YouTube because YouTube was still a budding platform. And there were a lot of auditors who, one in particular in South California that was, you know, his death is very much, I guess you could say, a conspiracy, because he was, you know, constantly doing audits on a police department that had never really faced anything like that before. He ended up being killed in his apartment after having posted on Reddit and several other sites that he was being followed, that they had thermal imaging. There's actually surveillance cameras that he had on his house that shows an unmarked van passing by with a thermal imaging camera in it. You know, and I'm sure that, you know, I'm positive that that's not an isolated incident, that police have the power to retaliate against people. And, you know, that's one of the reasons that I try to remain anonymous with, because I feel like a lot of people would interpret my channel as something that it's not. And I just can't take that risk, you know?
Mm-hmm. So you're protecting yourself from police violence and malfeasance against you because of your exposure of these audits.
Exactly. And I really had considered early on, I'd considered, you know, revealing my identity and being, you know, transparent about who I was and what I did. But after the channel started getting so much traction, and it just sort of exploded quicker than I ever thought it would, I decided not to, because I don't know what the future of that channel is. You know, I don't know how big or small it may become. And I just don't want to risk that level of exposure for myself, you know.
You know, I wanted to just draw a line of distinction. Again, the best part about the Audit the Audit YouTube channel is the nuance with which it approaches these stories, which are so layered in terms of the law and the circumstances that's what all these things cry out for. And I think that I just don't want to let it go unsaid. Serpico was a case where the police officers were an actual criminal gang in the precincts where they worked. They were distributing drugs. They were running protection for drugs. They were committing violence on behalf of for one drug dealer for another, collecting pickups, numbers, prostitutes, the whole nine yards. That's one kind of corruption. And I think that while that exists in the United States and police departments, I think it pales in comparison to the corruption of a cop sees another police officer put somebody in handcuffs to detain them. They know that detention is inappropriate, and they either do nothing to help see the citizen released, or they do, but then they don't follow up. They don't file a complaint against the crime that the one officer committed against the citizen. And that's the kind of thing that when I say that the police will cure themselves, meaning to get the police to do that, to police themselves legitimately, right? So anyway, that's sort of where I was headed with that.
Well, the reason that I brought up the psychological aspects of that is because I think that you're assigning a lot of power to an individual, you know, or a lot of responsibility, I guess. And I understand that that's an aspect of their job. But I think it's important for people, particularly people who don't like police, to try to view this through the lens of someone who is just carrying out a job, who's doing a job. And I think a lot of times, you know, no matter what industry you're in or what job you do, oftentimes you take shortcuts or you don't fulfill the duty up to the standards that you were trained to do. And a lot of times in a lot of industries, there's not appropriate repercussions for that. And I think that is exactly, it's a good parallel to what's happening in police forces. Now, I'm saying this not because I agree with it necessarily. I agree with you. I think that those officers should step up to the plate and try to hold their colleagues accountable for their actions. But I also think that it's more difficult than it seems, or more difficult than we want to acknowledge that it could be. You know, that there's, when it comes down to it, oftentimes I'm sure the decision that they're making here, even if they're a good cop and they do want to expose corruption from their colleagues, the philosophical question that they have to address in their head is my career, is my security, is my life even as important to me as this person's life, mm-hmm. or their security? And I think that it kind of does boil down to that simple question. And I, you know, honestly cannot always fault them for choosing to self-preservation over, you know, a grand act of heroism mm-hmm. or justness, you know.
Well, it's always important. I just want to say too, for me, and I at the risk of doing so out of turn, I'll speak for you too. Police officers have a really hard job. You know, they're dealing with people who lie to them all the time. They're often dealing with people who are before them on their very worst day of their lives for various circumstances. And that's the plate they're handed all. And they're not given, you know, it's one thing to go through the academy and learn how to do a takedown or handcuff somebody, but the psychological, you know, for their own well-being, how do they get through the day with this,
right,
this sea of crap they have to deal with?
I think that's another major aspect of, I think that the cure is not necessarily, the cure to this, the problem of police misconduct is not necessarily one-sided. I think that it's going to take a lot of different changes to make a dramatic impact on the way that police officers conduct themselves. And while I think that, you know, colleague accountability is certainly one aspect of that, I also think that, you know, the proper training, like more training focused more on the psychological aspects of police duties. And a major thing, this is sort of a little bit, I guess, hopeful and a little bit, not pessimistic. What's the opposite of pessimistic?
Optimistic.
optimistic. This is a bit optimistic and maybe even a whimsical thought, but it would be great if we could create some kind of independent federal, maybe. And I understand you're a libertarian, so you may or may not. Like
by the way, I'm already against it. I'm already against it, Frank. It's like there's bumper stickers maybe, that say I'm already
maybe,
against
maybe
it.
Not, maybe not even federal, but it could be local. But the problem with the, let me just say the idea, and then we can talk about the nuances of it. But some independent board or independent, you know, something that is totally detached from policing and individual departments or organizations that police people, that reviews each case which there may or may not have been misconduct in. And I think you could do that with maybe elected officials, or, you know, and maybe even take it down to the local level and have local offices whose job it is to purely just maintain some degree of accountability with police officers. Mm-hmm. And you have that in other industries, you know, you have boards, you have regulators, you have many different organizations that make sure that other organizations are doing their job correctly. And that's their whole job. You know, that's the whole point of the board, you know, like say the agricultural department, you know, that's sort of like their whole job.
You can look at the number of medical doctors, for instance, that are that have their licenses removed each year for various issues. Why aren't we removing the police, the licenses to be a police officer from? Are you telling me that police officers are generally better than doctors at maintaining their licensure or attorneys for that matter? One of the things, though, that I think is an insurmountable barrier unless it gets changed are these union contracts. You know, I recall there was I'm from the Philadelphia area originally. And I remember this one case. I wish I could remember a little bit more specifics about it, but a police officer conducted himself in a manner that was odious to the citizenry. And it was, on tape somewhere. And there was a conversation that a journalist wrote about then Governor Ed Rendell, and they said that the candid conversation between the two politicians was, well, you're going to have to fire him, but it doesn't matter because he's going to get rehired in a year, you know, with the back pay anyway. Mm-hmm. So you'll take a little hit, but it won't be that big a deal. And it's because of these union contracts that so many cities, especially the larger cities, have with their police officers that allows these bad apples to get back on the force.
Yeah, the thing about, you know, unions can be a tremendous asset to workers, but just as easily can be a tremendous detriment to civilians. You know, oftentimes they tend to have this blind loyalty to whoever's paying the bills, which, you know, often is the workers. And it's just, it's difficult to, you know, because it seems like in police unions, no matter what the police officer does, they back them no matter what. I mean, I just today read a story about an officer who came up and punched a man who was sleeping on the ground, who was under the influence of some drug, but punched him in the face, like, because he couldn't wake him up. And the police union is there trying to justify his actions too. And there, when there was just absolutely no excuse for that. And
Frank,
I believe that
Frank,
the jury,
Frank, you say punched in the face. They say closed hand directed energy wake up tool. Okay. That's what the, that's what the, they would say.
And I think that officer actually claimed that he was in fear for his life over the sleeping man. He was worried he might wake up at any moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that you talk about a lot on the channel, and this I think is something that I would just hope even the most strident police union could agree with, is de-escalation. We see so many interactions out there where you have a sort of, and forgive me for painting with a broad brush, police officers out there, but like a testosterone steroid addled tough guy who wants to insert himself as like the ruler of the area, yeah, instead of just trying to keep the peace. They themselves are disturbing the peace with the way they interact with the public.
Yeah, and that goes back to the whole police culture aspect of this, because a lot of them, it's you know, this is also painting with a broad brush, and I don't mean to sound as if I have some bias, but this is just an objective observation based on the many hours of police videos that I have watched and considered. But it seems as though like there's this archetype for police officers oftentimes where, you know, it's, they all behave in the same way, you know, or we're not all of them, but a lot of them behave in the same way. They have the same mannerisms. They have the same, you could probably sit them down and ask them about their life philosophies, and a lot of them would align. You know, it's just, there's this certain mentality and this. And, you know, the thing is, it's hard to distinguish whether or not that is a symptom of being a police officer or if they went into, or if they were attracted to the police officer job just because of the way that their mind works. And
I think that if any of us were police officers, by and large, we would behave the same way. The culture of that office, that, you know, all the things that go into it, from the, you know, you were talking earlier in the conversation about not being critical of a cop who's, you know, concerned about his own physical safety, right, rather than primarily. And I think that there's, you know, this notion that, like, you don't hear it quite as much anymore, but you used to hear it all the time, which is like the most important thing is that they get home, they go home to their kid, right? Yeah. Their family at night. And I think that the correct attitude for them should be that they make sure that all the rest of us go home to our kids and our families at night. Yeah. And we're not putting on the badge and the gun. They are. They're the ones who are volunteering, in a manner of speaking, for the paycheck, to put themselves into harm's way. And there seems to be at least too many who are willing to burden shift too much and place that safety burden on the public rather than incur it themselves.
Yeah, and this is where I will inject my personal opinion about this, because I think that that mentality, I agree with you that a lot of people who went into the police force probably would amount to the same mentality and psychological outlook that a lot of officers have. And I think that that's a major part of that, a major reason because of that is their training. And the fact that, you know, we started this part of the conversation about de-escalation. And I think that that doesn't play as significant of a role in their training as it should. And not only that, but while they're being taught all these, you know, combat moves and safety precautions and how to defend themselves, they're, you know, even if it's not being directly said to them, there's an implication by receiving so much training about all of that, that your job is inherently dangerous and that there's going to be times where, you know, you have to defend yourself and all that. But I mean, you know, statistics are oftentimes not reliable. And as a journalist, you learn that you can't depend on statistics to paint the whole picture. But there is an interesting statistic about this that I point out in one of my videos. And it's that if you're a police officer, you actually don't have the most dangerous job in the world. As a matter of fact, it's not even close to the most dangerous job in the world. And you have a 0.001% chance of being shot by someone who intended to kill you in the line of duty. And then,
yeah, well, for people who don't know, I'm sorry, go ahead.
And even still a low chance of even being involved in any kind of violence. And I think it's a 0.1% chance of being injured at all, you know. So police really don't have a dangerous job if you look at it through my lens.
They do have a very dangerous job with respect to traffic. They're in their cars and they're getting out of their cars, and that is actually where most police injuries and deaths occur, are these traffic issues, not from a criminal matter. But, you know, I know that when there's, let's say today, and I'll just pick a place, Topeka, Kansas, there's a police officer who stops a car and the guy shoots him and it's on the body cam. That's going to be on the roll call of every police officer, every police station by next week. And they're going to say, look what happened. And it's like, there's this, it's almost like the same thing that we have with the news with when the satellite news feeds got invented and every story was this massive fire on the news. You're watching some fire in Cleveland. If you're in Miami, and you never would have even, maybe you would have read about it a week later if it was particularly deadly, but you wouldn't see it every night. This idea that there's this constant threat to their lives that is part of building that culture, I think, that leads to where we are now. You know, Frank, when I was a kid, I thought the police officers were like nice, friendly, you know, community assets. And I think that most of the people I talk to today about the way they engage with the police, if they were alive back then, they had the same experience. And now they're seen as, you know, not that. You know, when I see a police officer, if I'm driving, I just automatically think, which of the 14 stickers that I'm supposed to have on this car to be legal that seem designed precisely to make it so that I'm not in compliance all at once, am I not in compliance with? And how might that screw me up? You know, how might they tax me based on that? Which is actually goes back to another thing, which is the politicians are requiring and requesting and demanding of these cops more and more and more, right? In schools, they're supposed to be guidance counselor. I mean, what, you know, we are asking perhaps an impossible amount from them.
I wouldn't say that. I mean, I wouldn't say that we're asking an impossible amount. I mean, it's definitely possible. It's just a matter of dedication and accountability. I mean, like, it's not like police officers don't spend, you know, a majority of their time at work sitting in their car or filling out paperwork. It seems like, you know, they have plenty of time to understand the duties that they're supposed to carry out. And it's not like we're over-regulating them, or it's not like they have like an extremely rigid agenda to follow. And I think that your point about politicians sort of pushing them to do more is a it's a product of the police, the people pushing the politicians to push the police to do more, you know, because they should be doing more. Obviously, there's a problem, you know, somewhere, regardless of who's, regardless of what the problem is or who caused that problem or why it's coming about. It's pretty universally accepted that America has some sort of policing problem. And if that were to have occurred in any other industry, say like America had some sort of nuclear power problem, that would be something that the people who operate nuclear plants should be addressing, you know? And I think that you could ask that of anyone who's in any industry. If they have a problem with the way that they do things, then they should probably fix that. And it's not,
in the nuclear field, it would be the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that would do this. And we do, right. we do have, well, I bring that up because earlier I bucked your idea about a federal, some kind of new federal agency. When these police officers violate the civil rights of the citizenry, they're committing a federal criminal act, which is violating of the civil rights of people. And the federal government, in the persons of the FBI and the U.S. attorney, the attorney general, could enforce those rules. They could start, you know, all we need is a president willing to use those resources. I think that that would really do a lot to sort of like tune up the police in terms of if they thought, well, you know what, if I violate this guy's rights, I may be wearing handcuffs myself. I know that maybe it's too much to ask for their, you know, their pal they've been eating lunch with for 25 years to arrest them for that. But the FBI agent from across town, maybe we can expect him reasonably to do that.
Right. I mean, to me, in a perfect world, we would dissolve the DEA and turn that into an accountability agency. You know, I feel like that'd be great. Of course, you know, that probably wouldn't work in the practical sense because, you know, there's a sense of camaraderie amongst all the departments of police.
Those are the last people I would pick to police the police, yeah. By the way. Why don't we send them out to learn how to do something? I don't know what. Let them be jockeys or I don't know what, you know, do something useful.
I wouldn't directly transplant those officers, but if we could just dissolve that department and use their funding to,
right,
you know, to build another agency, that would be great.
Okay. Well, let's thank you so much for your time. Audit the Audit is the channel. And if you have a second, I just want to talk, if you want to give any advice, because I know there's a lot of YouTubers and prospective YouTubers out there. The channel is only 6 months old. You have 9.26 million views as of this morning, as I check the stats. That's a fantastic result. You're not a celebrity. You don't have Beyonce tweeting about the channel, I'm guessing, to drive these viewers. Do you attribute your success to one thing in particular, or you know, what advice can you give to other YouTubers about how to be successful there?
Well, I wouldn't say that I can attribute my success to any one factor. You know, it's definitely a combination. You know, one thing I'd like to say about a channel like this is that it requires a lot of different skills to make all the parts work. You know, you have to, you know, I'm not only am I a journalist first and foremost, but I also, you know how to edit a video and Photoshop and just have a lot of different skills that I've sort of accumulated over the years that sort of came to a pinnacle with this channel. It's sort of what uses a lot of my skills to make one good product, you know.
And it is, my advice, it's a great product, Frank. So thank you so much for
that. I appreciate that. But my advice to an up and coming YouTuber is, you know, as far as like the auditing goes, is to do your research, do your homework, know every aspect of what you're getting yourself into before you decide to do it, because you're taking a great risk, not only to your life and limb potentially, but also to your finances, you know, the well-being of your family. I would even say, go as far as to say to, you know, be not do it if you don't know 100% that you are capable of doing it. If you have anything at all that you could potentially lose in your life and not get back, there's a good chance that that will happen. So don't take unnecessary risks. Know the laws, know your rights, and try to remain silent as much as possible.
I actually was looking for general YouTube advice for people, by the way, but I appreciate the specific advice for auditors or would-be auditors. Do you have anything else besides just generally that sort of,
Well, as far as the YouTube platform, it's a scary time to be a YouTuber right now. YouTube has a pretty heavy hand when it comes to what content they allow and what content they don't. And I've even, been afraid that my channel might even be removed, even though, I follow the guidelines as much as possible. All of my videos are censored. There's no vulgarity or violence in any of them. But it doesn't mean that it couldn't be interpreted in a certain way. And all the content that goes on YouTube is subject to interpretation and is, they're a private entity. It's really hard to make a case. If your channel has been deleted, that's pretty much the end of it. So if you're going to be a YouTuber, I would suggest, don't make it a career at first. Take it slow. It took many years for me to come up with a formula that worked and a formula that was fulfilling. And I would just say make content that's genuine and authentic to who you are and what you do and what your interests are. That's probably one of the most important things.
I will say on behalf of Frank, please visit Audit the Audit, like, comment, and subscribe. That's the thing that will help him the most if you enjoy it. And anything else you want to leave people with, Frank, before we go?
Be careful, be safe, and be wary.
Liberty Nation Gen Z. Becoming a strong defender of freedom and liberty doesn't just happen, it's taught. LN Gen Z is your portal for news that's hot, engaging articles without the spin. Go to lngenz.com for riveting videos that foster critical thinking. Download worksheets and quizzes for each age level. At lngenz.com, the future starts today. Combating propaganda, defending freedom. lngenz.com, a free thinking future starts here.